Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. That's permission, pay respects to Lumpur Liam and the Mahasangha, everyone gathered here. So I've been insistent on people being punctual. I'm aware of the clock being after 9 already, and we should be finishing by 9:30. And brevity is not my strong suit, as people will know, but I'll do my best to be succinct in what I'd like to offer. Well, it's been very delightful indeed to be in this gathering and to be, say, coming together to pay respects to our great teacher, Tancho Kumprom Vajiriyan, that we all know as Lumpo Sumeto, and listening to the many Dhamma reflections over the previous few days. And today, the many memories come to mind, many resonances of places and times and occasions, things that are brought to mind. So I thought I would just echo some of the principles that have been spoken of already in the last few days, but also to share some of the particularly meaningful, impactful teachings that Lumpo Sumeto has been imparting and sharing with us all in recent times. First of all, listening to Lumpo Viradamo talking about the challenging, vigorous days of the Hampstead Vihara. And news of this when I was an Anagarika, a Pākhau, and the Samanera, news of the rigorous routines that the Hampstead Vihara reached us through a number of aerograms and an occasional cassette, those of you who remember audio cassettes. And taped by Lumpo Sumeto or Ajahn Anando, others at the Vihara. So these stories of the cold showers at 3 in the morning, and then I remember one novice, Samanera Kasapo, when he came from Hampstead to Wat Pa Nanachat, said, yeah, Lumpo Sumeto really likes to encourage quality of vigor. So once in a while, we have these 10-hour sittings. You sit for 5 hours, and you have a five-minute loo break, then you have another 5 hours. So I thought, I don't really like the idea of this Ajahn Sumeto person. He sounds a bit off-putting, and I was very glad to have my Ajahn Pabakro, who was the successor of Lumpur Sumeto at Wat Pa Nanachat. I thought, he's much more reasonable. We get up at 3, for sure, and our showers do come out of an Ong Nam, and they're not heated, but you know, this is Thailand, and it's a lot warmer here. So I must admit, I confess, that my first impressions of Lumpur Sumeto were a bit off-putting. I felt intimidated, like, oh dear. I'm much more happy living here in Thailand. I didn't think I'd like the sound of things in England. So resonances of those thoughts were coming to mind as I heard Lumpur Viradamo speaking of those early days. So when circumstances came around after my first Vasa in the branch monastery in Roy Et, I became a bhikkhu again like Lumpur Jandia. I was very fortunate to have Lumpur Cha as my upajaya. I was in Arun three years after Lumpur Jandi. So my first reigns as a bhikkhu was at the branch monastery in Roy Et with Ajahn Ruangrit at Wat Pa Parom Pratan. And my father had a heart attack, and I came at the end of the Pansa, and I came scooting back to England. And so Chithurst Monastery had just begun a few months prior to that, and so I took the opportunity after being with my family for a couple of days. I went down to Chithurst, fortunately in the next county over, and met Lumpur Sumeto for the first time. So again, I still felt a bit daunted, like, yeah, what's this fearsome Ajahn actually going to be like face to face? And as Ajahn Chandasiri and Ajahn Jayasaro were describing their first encounters as young people with Lumpur, there was this extraordinary friendliness, geniality, and warmth in meeting him. And so I felt, oh, all of that anticipation was unnecessary. That trepidation was unnecessary. And there's this quality of extraordinary kindness and supportiveness that he expressed. I was just a one Vasa bhikkhu. I was 23 years old, just coming back to the West for the first time. And I asked him, Tanajan, do you have any advice for me to go with, to stay with my family? You know, what sort of guidelines should I have for the practice? And he simply said, don't be difficult. Because he could see I was a very sort of keen monk trying to do everything right, young and ardent, vigorous, and very, very concerned to keep the Vinaya and very strictly into practice properly. And that was such helpful advice, that you're going into your family's world. Your father's just had a heart attack, and as soon as he was out of the ICU, my mother collapsed. So she was in one hospital, and my father was in another. So the family was pretty traumatized already, and having the lad of the family coming home and being a Buddhist monk, you know, English, rural English life. You know, it was weird enough that I went off to London to study psychology at university, but coming back a couple of years later from Thailand, dressed like this. At that time, my mother took me to the post office to close off my post office account, which was still alive. We were in the post office, and I was chatting with Mrs. Marchant behind the desk in the post office, and the publican, Dick, who was about 6'5" and about this wide, appeared in the doorway of the post office and took one look at me and said, with my shaved head and robes, "Stone me!" I'm glad he didn't faint, because it would have caused some damage in the post office if he had keeled over. So that was extraordinarily good advice. Don't be difficult. You know, your family are having to deal with you being a Buddhist monk. So lay down the principles that that are important for you, that you need to establish. That you don't eat in the afternoon, and you don't hug women, and you are living by this code, but do what you can to adapt and fit in and work with a family. So that was tremendously good advice. Also, listening to Ajahn Chandasiri talking about the early days of Chithurst, that again brought back many memories. Also listening to Lumpo Sujito and the early days of Chithurst Monastery and this kind of derelict house that we were staying in. The fact that it was filled with dry rot, there was 22 rooms, only 4 of which were habitable. What's now the shrine room at the house had a huge hole in the floor that had been eaten away by dry rot. So it was rough living conditions, but that didn't matter one bit. Because every day, every morning, Lumpur Sumedho would be offering mind-blowing, world-stopping reflections. They were not to make people jealous, envious, but they were golden days. And through end of 79, 1980, 81, 82, during much of that time, even though I was a young, restless monk with a mind that wouldn't stop thinking and a mouth that wouldn't stop talking, as my brothers will attest, you only get this once in a lifetime. This is not—you're not going to get a second chance at this. This is so wonderful, so perfect. This extraordinary wisdom teachings and this wonderful community centered around the spiritual qualities and the kindness and wisdom of Lumpur Sumedho, right at the very center. It was created an extraordinary kind of vortex of goodness that we were all a part of. And I felt just extraordinarily blessed. It was a beautiful and powerful time. So I put my hands in Anjali and expressed my great gratitude that I was able to begin my monastic training very much in that environment. I feel so blessed on account of the teachings that we all received during that time, and the encouragement and the sense of confidence that was imparted by Lumpo Sumedho's wonderful example at that time. I was also in listening to Ajahn Jayasaro's talk this afternoon. I learnt a new Pali word, bhavaniyo, that quality of emulation and wanting to follow the example of your teachers, your mentors, and and how you are blessed and improved. They bring out the best in you. So I looked it up in Buddha Dhamma, Dhansomdet Payut's great tome. What was that word Ajahn Jayasaro was using? So I took the trouble to look it up today, bhavaniyo. And I realized as he was speaking, I had the same kind of experience, that I wouldn't have a hope if it wasn't for this great teacher and this great community. And many of you have heard me say that a number of times in Dhamma talks, that I'm quite happy to admit, to confess, if I tried to do this on my own, I wouldn't have a hope. Yeah, and I am deeply grateful for the support and blessing of the Sangha, but that Sangha would not be have been existing in the Western world had it not been for the presence, the strength, the resolution, and the endurance, the patient endurance of Lumpo Sumedho, the readiness to go through those many difficulties that Lumpo Jandi was just speaking about, and also many of the other Ajahns speaking today and previously. That is, again, a sense of great gratitude. Like, thank you so much that I've had the chance to be a part of this extraordinary group of human beings committing their life, their energies, their capacities to following the path of the Lord Buddha and being, say, guided by the teachings of Lumpur Cha and particularly by the living present example here in the West of Lumpur Sumedho. Another aspect of what Ajahn Jayasaro was saying this afternoon was Lumpur Sumedho's extraordinary, what you could call, dialectical skill, that way of responding to questions and teaching and working with people in situations. And he talked about that incident of someone coming and kind of attacking Lumpur Sumedho. What would you do if a maniac attacked your mother? You know, as a sort of theoretical issue about being a pacifist, and Lumpur's response. And it was a long time ago, and I can't remember whether I was actually there or whether maybe Ajahn Sujito told the story, or Lumpur Sumedho told the story. But it was at an event in Cambridge, and there was an ardent PhD student who was studying nuclear war. If I remember correctly, his thesis was called Hiroshima Apocalyptic and the Antinomian Christ. That's quite a mouthful. And that he was very ardent, very sincere, very good-hearted person, but he had got the impression that as Buddhist monastics, there was a philosophical attitude that he was uncomfortable with. And again, I can't remember whether I was there or whether it was the account of Ajahn Sujito or Lumpur speaking about it. But the dynamic of that encounter was this very good-hearted, well-informed, sincere person who was very anti-war and anti-nuclear weaponry. And he addressed Lumpur with a very contentious and aggressive attitude. The memory I have of that account was that Lumpur kind of received this input from this PhD student, and so took the energy of his approach, his sort of fierce expression, and received it, and then responded from a completely different place. And very much as Lumpur Cha would do, he didn't respond to the words of the question. He went to the place where it came from in the person. And maybe I remember, but Lumpur Sumedho responded by saying in a very gentle way, well, we've come here to talk about peace, and we're all very concerned about peace, but you just started a war. So I can't ignore that. And it came from such a clear and straightforward and honest place that it apparently changed the dynamic of the exchange. Both today, Ajahn Chandasiri was talking about that pati-pati puja, the offering of our practice, Lumpo Pasano, the other evening, also pati-pati puja, the puja. Amisa puja is material offerings of flowers, candles, incense, material gifts to support monastics and to support good causes. That's called Amisa puja, material offerings. Pati-pati puja is offering our practice, and I feel that is very much in the spirit of Lumpur Sumedho's teaching, that he's always been concerned with the essence and not with the externals. And as people have also been saying, he's always ready to go beyond the familiar ways of expression or familiar approaches and really come from the heart and address the essence of things. And I remember when Dhamma teaching, I think it was in the old sala that we demolished a year or two ago, and with great strength and vehemence, he said, "I'm not interested in turning you all into a bunch of bloody Buddhists." And he almost kind of spat the word Buddhist like it was some horrible insult or something, kind of something despicable or kind of off-putting. What an awful thought to be taking on these robes and shaving our heads in order to just to make a new identity. And many times during ordination ceremonies, he would make that same kind of point. You don't become a Buddhist monk to be a monk. Yeah, you become a Buddhist nun or a Buddhist monk in order to support liberation. That's what it's for. It's not to create a new identity. And so he was he's always been extraordinarily courageous and straightforward, bold in his these kind of expressions. So I again, like Lumpur Jandi was just saying, one could come up with many, many stories and examples of this over the years. But I thought that was a particularly notable occasion where you think, well, aren't we Buddhists, Ajahn? We're putting a lot of effort into doing this and keeping all the rules and building this place. But to him, that was absolutely clear what he meant. And when we listened closely to our own hearts, we all knew exactly what he meant. Yeah, it's not a costume to wear. It's not just another identity. It's a vehicle for liberation. So in terms of some of his recent teachings that I've been really touched by, one thing he said recently was, there's no such thing as an enlightened person. Again, that sounds a bit non-Buddhist. He said, no, there's no such thing as an enlightened person. From the outside, someone might validly say, this person's enlightened and that person isn't. But from the inside, there isn't a person. There's the awake mind watching the personal qualities arise and pass away, but that which knows the person isn't a person. And again, he would make these kind of comments from a very clear and direct place in his mind. And again, if we're listening closely, then we can really attune to and intuit the meaning of that, where that's coming from. This which knows the person isn't a person. This which knows the feelings of the body, emotions and thoughts and memories, they arise and they pass away. But this conscious awareness, which the term he's using most often these days, this conscious awareness, it knows the personal, but it's not a person. It's not male or female, old or young, doesn't have an age. It isn't located anywhere. This mind is unbound, is undesignated by those qualities. It's awake, it's aware, it knows, but it's not a person. It knows the personal, but it's not a person. Similarly, a few weeks ago, he made the comment, Dhamma has no language, using words to say that. So, hang on, isn't that a contradiction, Lumpur? Dhamma has no language, or conscious awareness has no language. We use language to talk about that, but awareness itself is beyond language. It has no words. It has no structures. Words, concepts, numbers, these don't apply. So that this quality of awakened awareness, it knows those forms and structures of language and concept, but it's not formed out of that. It's not limited by that. Another of the comments we included in this little booklet, it's like this, that Thumpho made a few years ago, which again, and all these I feel are very worthy of contemplation and has come up in his recent teachings about time and timelessness, where he made the comment, time is an illusion caused by ignorance. I'm looking at the clock. 9:23 and counting. So time is an illusion caused by ignorance, but don't worry, I won't keep you here all night to fulfill Lompo Sopon's encouragement for the all-night meditation. But, another of the teachings that he's shared recently then is resonated on the cups that we made. I hope people have been able to receive your mugs with the LPS 90 logo and the quotation from the sutta, that this conscious awareness that knows the field of perceptions, it knows those objects of awareness, but it's not limited by awareness. Like right now, here, experiencing the temple at Amaravati, this awareness which knows this moment, it knows the objects of awareness, the people, the space, the pillars, the lights, the sound of this voice. It knows these objects, but the conscious awareness, this vijja dhatu, or the vijja ayatana, this quality of knowing, it's not burdened by the objects that it is aware of. It's not limited by those. And in that that quotation that is on the mug, that hopefully many of you have received, this is one of Lumpur's favorite teachings, vinyanang anidasanang anantang sabato babang. That consciousness, which is non-manifestative, which is non-manifest, which has no form, which is radiant, and which is the basis of awareness. This is, as the Buddha describes in the teachings, that long and short and coarse and fine and pure and impure, they can find no footing there. They can find no landing place there. So these teachings that Lumpur Sumedho not only expounds, but I feel also embodies in the way he relates to his own life, his mind, his own physical being, and that he doesn't give anything a place to land. And that's the most wonderful example. He doesn't reject the presence of his aging body and its limitations, but he's not grasping it, he's not identified with it. He treats it with respect, but it's not given a landing place. So this kind of presence in our midst as a living teaching and is an embodiment of that very principle he's explaining and talking about very often, I feel is a wonderful gift to us all. So may we follow that example and not give long and short and coarse and fine and pure and impure and earth, water, fire and wind a place to land. And then when that is the way that we guide the heart, guide our attitude, then in the midst of all of the worldly conditions and activities and complications of organizing a grand event, then the heart is at peace, the heart is unburdened and without limits. So I will offer these thoughts for reflection and invite Lumpur Kevali to summarize. And I'm feeling very proud that I did that within by 9:25.